You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm Daryl West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. And I would like to welcome you to our summit on mobile's impact on emerging economies and global opportunities. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country and around the world. We also will be archiving this video, so anyone who wishes to view it later can do so at brookings.edu. We also would welcome any questions or comments that you have. We have set up a Twitter feed at hashtag TechCTI. That's hashtag TechCTI. So you can post any questions or comments that you have on that site. Mobile technology represents a growing part of the economy and the driver of considerable economic growth. The global mobile economy now is estimated at $1.6 trillion and is projected to reach $2 trillion by 2017. We know that mobile technology has created new industries and revolutionized both business practices and societal improvements worldwide. This has created enormous economic opportunities for billions of people, and it has enabled new forms of learning, healthcare, disaster relief, and poverty alleviation. But despite the importance of mobile technology, there remain barriers to innovation and invention. There is considerable variation from country to country in how it handles this sector. Plus, there are macro barriers in the sense that two-thirds of the world's population is not yet connected to the internet. So we need to figure out how to build the mobile ecosystem and extend the benefits of mobile to many more people. Today, we're going to discuss the factors affecting mobile investment and invention around the globe. We have two panels. Our first panel is going to look at mobile technology and how it enables social and economic opportunity. We're pleased to welcome Bill Bold to Brookings. Bill is a Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Qualcomm, and in that position, he manages the company's public policy agenda and its relationship with government entities and related organizations at the international, federal, state, and local levels. He also manages a global group that includes people in the United States, Brazil, China, Belgium, India, France, Korea, and South Africa. I think that sounds like more than one job there, but. And before joining Qualcomm, Bill worked as a director of public policy for the California Healthcare Institute. Interviewing him will be Brooks Bullock. Brooks is a technology reporter for Politico, and he has covered a wide range of technology topics in Congress and the White House and also at the Federal Communications Commission, and he also has some international interest as well. So he's very knowledgeable about technology issues, and I will turn it over to Brooks.
Yeah, I only have one job, but I do it for Politico, so that means I do it a lot. Anyway, it's great to see everybody here. Bill, let me just start out. One of my best friends sent me a picture the other day of where his daughter is in the Peace Corps in Ghana. And the picture was of the village where she's stationed. And there's one road, and on each side were what looked like mud huts. I think they were mud. I want to say they were whitewashed, but they were kind of a green tint, so I don't know what they were using to tint their paint. What does mobile technology do for a place like that?
Well, thank you, Brooks, and thank you, Daryl, for that kind introduction. Without knowing specifically the village you're referencing, there's a lot that mobile broadband has and will continue to do for rural communities around the world. And the first thing is simply attract investment. Most of the world, as Daryl mentioned, is not yet connected to the internet at meaningful speeds. There are about 7 billion wireless connections in the world, and that corresponds to about 3.5 billion unique users. So it's about two connections for every unique user. But a lot of those connections are second generation. Those are folks using their phones for voice, maybe a little bit of texting, but not the type of wireless internet experience that we've come accustomed to in this country. So when wireless technology, mobile broadband, gets introduced into a market like that, you get an enormous increase in investment. because you're leapfrogging an entire generation of technology. You're going from, you know, maybe no phones at all or very simple, basic, essentially disposable voice phones to phones with displays that can browse the internet, can connect to data services and add value, enormous value for the user. So we've seen in lots of emerging regions who are just now auctioning spectrum for 3G and even fourth generation technology, you know, companies falling all over themselves to get at that market opportunity. That's great for the GDP of the country in question. On a more human level, mobile broadband unlocks a host of social services that can really transform communities. Just off the top of my head, my group manages a kind of a strategic philanthropy program at Qualcomm called Wireless Reach. We've got about 104 advanced mobile broadband.
Speaking of wireless.
No, we love that. We love that. That's never tell it. We never tell anybody to silence their cell phones. 104 projects around the world doing advanced wireless projects in both developed markets, but even more so in developing markets. And I'll give you a couple of examples of things we're doing. The first is a program actually not in Africa, but in Indonesia. We essentially sell a micro business in a box in partnership with the Grameen Foundation in very rural parts of Java and Sumatra. These are villages that don't have access to telecommunications. And we give village phone operators, which are mostly women, about 82% of the operators are actually women, we give them a mobile phone with a 3G data connection. And they then resell not only voice time to their neighbors and their communities, but also advanced data services. So things like job board postings, you know, where can I get seasonal work, information about weather for farmers, stuff that we would take for granted, but is really revolutionary in Indonesia. Every one of those village phone operators is profitable, and it's basically lifting women up in that market. We're doing similar things in Africa. More close to home in Africa, we're actually looking at ways to develop applications to help frontline Ebola workers get information about the spread of the disease, communicate that back to the WHO, so we have sort of a real-time map of what's actually happening with Ebola. So from healthcare to entrepreneurship to education, mobile broadband lifts the floor for all these communities around the world.
What sort of barriers are there that keep you from pushing these advanced services to less developed countries?
Well, the one thing that our industry needs desperately is two things. Investment, first of all. So we need, you know, countries that welcome foreign investment, that don't have the sorts of restrictions on, you know, American or European or Asian investors coming in and putting money into their economies. So, you know, those countries that don't have, you know, direct state control or even ownership of the mobile networks, that's an important step. And the other one is spectrum. Spectrum is the real estate that our industry depends on. And what we found is that those countries that are most aggressive about making the hard decisions to free up spectrum to say, look, we've got to move to new technology platforms. We can't, you know, essentially do the same old thing of catering to incumbents. Those are the countries that get the investment. Those are the countries whose networks come up to speed, you know, the quickest, and the ones that are frankly doing better looking internationally.
So you mentioned spectrum. And so did most of these countries, do they auction off the spectrum like we do?
It's a mix. I think, you know, auctions have become very popular. It's a great way to meet your budget and pay the bills.
42 billion popular, I guess.
Well, it very much depends on, you know, we can't comment obviously on the current proceeding in the United States, but around the world, you know, money is flowing into some, you know, fairly surprising places. I mean, I just met with the Pakistani regulator a couple weeks ago, and they have, you know, companies falling all over themselves to get into that market. They have a little bit of third-generation communication, basically in the big cities, Karachi, Islamabad, and the like. And they now want to move to fourth-generation and spread that out through the rural regions, which are terribly underserved in Pakistan. That's a country that's gone through, you know, a lot of strife, a lot of political instability, and you still have, you know, enormous desire to get in there to address, you know, what is basically a completely unserved market.
I was kind of struck by what you said about the person in Indonesia that becomes an operator, because being a telephone operator was also one of the first jobs for women in the United States when you used to do wireline, and you literally, the operators had a switchboard in their house and they would plug in BR549 or whatever. So basically these countries aren't going to do any wireline investments?
Well, no, they will do wireline. I mean, eventually a wireless connection gets to a wired network and to the internet. So there has to be some investment. But you look at a country like Indonesia, which is an archipelago. The Philippines is another, you know, very good example. It's impossible, literally, to connect all of those communities in the rural part of the country. If you meet with, as I've had the good fortune of doing, meet with Indonesian federal officials, they are, you know, just hyper-focused on how do we develop eastern Indonesia, which is a pocket of small islands close to Papua New Guinea. Almost impossible to connect with wires. You've got to connect wirelessly, but then there's got to be a backhaul. There's got to be the fiber network you eventually connect to, which may be in a big city, a Sulawesi or Jakarta or what have you. So it's a mix. But that last mile connection is definitely going to be wireless in most parts of the world.
So does that experience that you've had internationally, does that translate to the United States to, you know, there's always problems with universal service, you know, reaching people in the rural areas and connecting people to broadband. It's a big push by the president. It's a big push at the FCC. They're going to do a rulemaking tomorrow on the Connect America Fund Phase 2. I mean, do we have those same problems here, or do the problems come with a different flavor?
Well, we've got a big country. You know, it's a very different situation than, you know, what we run into in lots of European countries where population is much more concentrated. I mean, what I can say about what we do at Qualcomm is we invest a lot of our research and development. We've invested cumulatively about $30 billion over the life of the company. About 20% of our revenues go right back into R&D every year. And a lot of what we invest in is designed to solve these very problems. In fact, there's really two problems that we've been looking to address. The first is congestion in the big cities, in markets that have really high wireless penetration, to make sure that we can expand data capacity by as much as 1,000 times over the next 10 years. And we're going to do that by deploying small cells. So a cell, you know, no bigger than this, connects into the wall. It's technology that Qualcomm helped develop. So these small cells can work in a network without interfering with one another, and you can greatly amplify the capacity that the network has. In rural areas, we're looking at ways to make spectrum used more efficiently. We're looking at ways to utilize lower bands of spectrum, which have greater propagation, can cover more of a kind of a wider range, things like the 700 megahertz band, very important in that respect. So a lot of what we do in R&D is really designed to solve or help solve the problems that policymakers are dealing with here and around the world.
It always seems kind of odd to me. I mean, you know, when I think of spectrum, I think of like AT&T, Verizon, T-Mo, Sprint, the big four, you know. But what you do also has a huge impact on that, like you're talking about these small cells, these mesh developments, particularly in the big cities. I know you can't comment on the ongoing auction at the FCC, but if you look at the auction, their auction website, New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, that's where the bulk of the money's going. So, I mean, is it easier to do the big cities with these kind of deployments? You might have already answered that question, but let me go ahead and delve down into that a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I'll say as a predicate, I'm not a network engineer, so
neither am I.
But there are people at Qualcomm a heck of a lot smarter than me who should answer that. My understanding, though, is that they're just different types of challenges. You know, making sure that you've got enough bandwidth and connectivity in a rural market can be every bit as challenging. They're just different technical problems, you know, and we try to. what we do in our R&D program, there's actually a lot of, synergy between not only the government affairs group, which I've mentioned, but also kind of the sales and business development group. So to get out there, provide engineering services to operators around the world, understand what kind of topography they're dealing with, what kind of demographics they're dealing with, and then try to tailor networks to serve them. I talked about the $30 billion in R&D. You know, it's really a reinvestment in the health of the network, and that's obviously an economy that we participate in and we benefit from, but we're plowing the money back into it in a way that we think lifts everybody's boats at the end of the day.
What are the major barriers you face in the United States?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think on the issue of spectrum, you know, we work very closely with the U.S. government on. I'll touch more on some of the barriers, I think, to innovation in the U.S. You know, the U.S. is the gold standard. Having been around the world, done government affairs in many markets, people speak, you know, in almost hushed, awed terms about how wonderful our system of patent protection is. And I wonder whether we've taken that for granted a little. That we're always going to have a strong patent system. We're always going to develop a lot of IP in this country. We're always going to have great universities coming out with the next wonderful idea and then transferring that into the private sector. But I've seen a lot of countries catch up. You know, you look at which companies file the most patent applications in our industry right now? Chinese companies. And you know, a lot of that's supported directly by the state. They've made it a big priority. But it's not at all a given that the U.S. is going to maintain its leadership. And what we need to do is, you know, really redouble our investments in both basic and applied research, which I think both parties, you know, at least say the right thing about whether we do it or not. It's another question. And then we have to realize that it's not just the patent system. It's not just protection of patents. It's the preservation of a free and fair market for intellectual property. The fact that companies like ours can make massive billion-dollar bets on really speculative technology that may or may not work out. The reason that we can make those bets, the reason our shareholders and our board of directors gives us the rope with which to do that, is because there's a market where we can recoup that investment. We can license that technology out to the rest of the industry. And there's an equilibrium that exists between the sellers of technology and the buyers of technology. And unfortunately, that equilibrium is being tinkered with by the Congress on, it seems like, a near annual basis by various regulatory bodies, not only here but around the world. And we ought to be really, really careful before we make wholesale changes in a system that's the envy of the rest of the world.
So what sort of changes do you fear?
Well, as I said, there's an equilibrium between innovators, and the folks who license that technology from inventors. A lot of the proposals, you know, for so-called patent reform that we've seen really tilt that equilibrium very much in the direction of licensees, and we think would limit the rights of inventors to get a fair shake, or a fair share, a fair, you know, return on the investment that they've made. And so we've been very active working with the Congress and the administration on these issues. But, you know, things like limiting the damages that a company could get if their patents are infringed upon. You know, we take the long view here. You know, Qualcomm was founded in 1985. It was six university professors, six academics, eggheads, you know, in a living room in La Jolla. Came up with an idea for, you know, a revolutionary company that today employs 30,000 people, does $24 billion in sales, and is really, you know, we think developed some terribly important technology for all of us. They never would have got that company off the ground if they didn't have both protection for their patents and a free and fair market with which to license that technology. The patent reforms that have been suggested in the past couple of Congresses, if those had been law in 1985, I don't think Qualcomm would ever happen.
So you don't fear the patent troll?
Well, I think the first question is, what is a patent troll? Okay. you know, patent trolls.
The answer is it depends.
It's a, you know, it's a slogan. It's a cliche. There are things you can do to get at bad actors in the system. And in fact, there was legislation we supported last year to get at this notion of demand letters going into users of various you know, Wi-Fi and other technology. There are very targeted things that can and should, probably should be done to rein that in. But, you know, we tell policymakers they should be very careful before making wholesale comprehensive changes to the patent system to get at this so-called problem. And we also, frankly, would love to see some evidence that the patent troll issue is a real problem, a real drag on the economy. We've got
always I always kind of root for the underdog. I love stories about invention. Dr. Jacobs has got a great one. And sometimes what I feel like is that some of these companies that don't support the that don't feel so much for the underdog, maybe because now they're the overdog, are trying to pull up the ladder behind them. So that, you know, in some ways it's like, you know, they actually stifle innovation instead of encouraging it.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. But, you know, when it comes to pulling up the ladder, I mean, you know, we've been very successful. You know, our technology is driving the phones of the folks in this room and the phones of the folks on the webcast. But we believe passionately that you shouldn't pull up the ladder because we're interested in the health of the overall mobile ecosystem. And the next great idea may not come from Qualcomm. It may come from a small startup here in the United States, some other country around the world. And that invention will, you know, make that company very profitable probably, but it'll also add to the overall experience and it'll help everyone else. But I, you know, if I could just amplify a little bit, it's not just pulling up the ladder. I think there are a lot of companies that just have very different business models now. They're product companies. They look at intellectual property simply as an input cost, like any other input cost. And they want to limit, you know, the cost that they have to pay to get access to it. They're not doing a lot of, you know, direct innovation. They're making products, making those products more effective. It's a very useful, you know, thing to do. But at the end of the day, I think what this country cares about is inventing things, inventing new platforms, inventing new technologies, and moving the dial in a meaningful way, not just selling products, not just selling services.
America has always been a technological country. I like to think about they, you know, they invented their own form of democracy. They went on to invent, you know, obviously we don't have a stranglehold on invention, but it just seems like the United States, we feel like we can invent our way out of every problem, and that if we face a problem, that if we come up against a problem, there is a way that we can figure out a way to invent ourselves around the problem. That's kind of a global statement. I don't think any answers. Let me see. Are there any questions out there? Have, you know, shoot.
I'm Fred Altman. Some of the regulations that are going to be passed are going to be detrimental. Are there measures in place that will rapidly identify what problems are caused by the regulation so that one can step back when necessary?
Are you just playing whack-a-mole? Regulation, bam, regulation, bam. Or do you have an overarching view?
Short answer is no. There's not such a system. No, there's a lot that companies like ours try to do, and it's not just us. There's all sorts of companies in the industry who try to sort of proactively give governments around the world, particularly in emerging regions where they might not have the sort of regulatory framework that you do in Western Europe or East Asia or the United States, to say, look, this is how you know, essentially build a regulatory infrastructure. One of the things you mentioned, auctions. There are some actually big countries around the world that still don't auction spectrum. Japan doesn't have the legal authority to auction spectrum, which blows my mind every time I say it. And that stifles, you know, innovation, investment, technology diversity, a bunch of stuff. So when a country is just sort of setting things up, we try to work with them, no matter where they are, to ensure that they've got the right type of framework, because we're also interested, you know, very much in economies of scale, right? If you look at the African continent, it doesn't really do our companies any good if Nigeria has one system, Ghana's got another system, and you know, West Africa has five different regulatory regimes, and they're using different bands of spectrum. Well, that's going to make it very difficult for us to develop products that can address that entire market. So there's a lot of work that happens at the front end.
You mentioned the, and I keep going back to auctions because obviously it's on my mind covering the FCC. And one of the questions that the commission is dealing with is that, you know, in the wireless infrastructure here, we basically have four players. And Verizon and AT&T are dominant. Sprint and T-Mobile are always trying to play this game of catch-up. What if Verizon and AT&T are able to buy up all the spectrum? Does that harm innovation?
Well, you're trying to get me to talk about this auction.
No, I'm not trying to get you to talk about this particular auction. I'm just thinking auctions in general. We're going to have an auction eventually, probably, of the broadcast spectrum coming up to 600 megahertz. That's low-band auction. That's stuff goes a long way. It penetrates walls. It's highly desirable. The current auction, the way it's explained to me, that spectrum is not quite as it's not quite as good. It's good for other things, but I'm just trying to talk about it in general because it's a question for both of the auctions and whatever other auction they have.
Well, you know, I'll actually pivot a little bit and talk about, because I think your question is about market concentration. And I'll talk a little bit about Latin America, which is, you know, an interesting region for us and one that's, you know, frankly not developed quite as quickly as we would have hoped. With a couple of exceptions, and I'll explain the relation to of those exceptions. So in a lot of countries in Latin America, you have two big operators. It's almost like a duopoly type situation. And regulators have not, you know, been particularly strong in combating those operators. You know, frankly, mobile broadband penetration is not where it should be, even in some very developed Latin American countries. One exception is Brazil. Brazil has done extraordinarily well. They've welcomed investment into the country. Telecom Italia is one of the major investors in the Brazilian wireless market. They also had some demographic changes, or the creation of a middle class overnight during the Lula and now Rousseff administrations. And you know, the takeoff of smartphone ownership has just, you know, gone through the roof. What's really interesting in Latin America is in Mexico now, in the Peña Nieto administration, they have really beefed up their, they created an entirely new telecom regulator. They gave them like, I think, 8-year terms of office. It's the highest paid public official, I think, in Mexico beneath the president and his cabinet. So they want basically to have the strongest possible regulator to be able to steer the market. So when you have more of a balance, I mean, I think the Mexican market's going to see new players come in and going to see more investment. So there's got to be a balance, I think. You know, while saying that, you know, the companies rolling out these networks, this is, you know, billion dollar stuff. You need the incentives in place so they can make those bets, roll out the infrastructure. It doesn't happen by magic. So the question is, how do you achieve that balance? And in developing markets, it's still very much an open question.
Questions? Yes, sir. The gentleman here with the red scar.
My name is Rich Wilhelm. Could you comment on, I mean, as the world shifts toward mobile technologies, and certainly the ecosystem is going that way, could you comment a little bit on cybersecurity and the vulnerabilities there, but in particular, what sort of regulatory environment of wishes for horses would you like to see? And what do you need in the U.S. market in terms of regulation? What would you like to see?
On cybersecurity?
Yes, on cybersecurity, not auction. This is the security issue.
So we've been engaged on that topic, although not quite as much as some of the other players in the industry because we're not a network infrastructure player. We're obviously not an operator of services either. It probably won't surprise you to say that I think we need a balance between the very real concerns about security and a relatively light touch. Cybersecurity is linked very closely to the question of internet governance. And I think there are some countries around the world that are that could potentially use the issue of cybersecurity to do a bunch of other things that would not have much benefit for the ecosystem. And it's related, not only to national governance of the internet, what content do you let into your country, but things like local content standards. We're dealing with an issue in, I keep coming back to Indonesia, I don't know why, but in Indonesia where they're trying to push local content as a requirement on mobile systems. And, their objective here is to try to develop a content industry in Indonesia. It's very, very laudable goal. But there are other ways to skin that cat than putting restrictions in place. So it's very much coming together now. And we're starting to get involved in a number of forums around the world that are discussing these issues. But, I think we'll see what the answer is. And crucially, whether we can get some degree of consensus between the big players around the world. And I think that's that would be ideal. But right now, I think that might be a long shot. Yeah, and we've. Well, I think they are trying to show leadership, and we're certainly supportive of that. And we have been, again, we're not on the infrastructure side, not on the services side, but we are trying to participate in those forums more aggressively.
Saw a bunch of other hands, people. That let's start at the back and go forward. We'll start with this lady here with the.
Hi, Dorothy Robine. There's been a lot of focus in on getting the federal government to free up spectrum, and a lot of it on the Department of Defense because they're the biggest spectrum user in the federal government. But DoD is also a major innovator, maybe the greatest engine of technological innovation ever created. I think some of the technologies that Qualcomm is built on came out of DoD. Do you have the sense that today, the Department of Defense is an innovator in this area? Do you work with DoD? Are they doing enough in that area?
Thank you, Dorothy. Great question. The short answer is yes to both. We do view them as an innovator, and we view them as a partner in innovation. As you note quite correctly, there has been in the past technology transfer from DoD. Other federally funded research to companies like Qualcomm, things like Push-to-Chat came out of federally funded investment programs. When I talk about funding for applied research, I'm very much talking about the need to support those sorts of activities. With respect to the question on spectrum, that's actually a very good example of the partnership I mentioned early on in the talk between R&D-intensive companies like Qualcomm and governments when it comes to freeing up spectrum and getting services out. So we actually developed a new regulatory paradigm that we call authorized shared access, because we realized that there are essentially three blocks of spectrum that we have to utilize around the world. There's licensed spectrum, which is always the most preferable. It's free from interference, quality of service, and the like. There's unlicensed spectrum. That's something we also develop products and technologies for. But then there's a third category of encumbered spectrum that's not used on a 24/7 basis. And some of the DoD spectrum you mentioned is a good example of that. An even better example is the 2.3 gigahertz band in Europe, which is, so 2.3 gigahertz, for those of you who don't know, spectrum is a band that's being used for mobile broadband, particularly in the Asia Pacific, but really it's going to be one of the really important worldwide bands. In Europe, it's occupied by ministries of defense. They don't use it on a 24/7 basis, and they don't use it in the entire geographic region of their country. So in a place like in France, it might be utilized in Paris, it might be utilized on the coast, maybe in Marseille or Lyon, but in most of the country it's completely unused, but it's licensed nationally. So the regulatory paradigm we came up with is a way that the phone, using very simple technology, can sense, you know, is the network being used? And if it's not being used, you basically capture that as surplus bandwidth that can be used by commercial operators. So that's technology we developed. It's a regulatory paradigm that we sort of came up with, first in Europe, but now we're working in the United States. But it requires a partnership with the spectrum holder, DoD, with the commission, with other interested players. But if we can do those sorts of things, we're going to get to the 1,000x goal of, you know, greatly increasing the capacity so everybody can watch, you know, Grumpy Cat on the phone and all the other videos that people...
I love Grumpy Cat. There's been a idea floated a couple of times. The first time I heard it was FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel mentioned it, that somehow you can incentivize, you can actually pay the incumbent, the DOD. I mean, you know, you see all this big money that auctions are generating. If I'm in the, you know, if I'm a spectrum manager at the DOD, I'm going, well, why can't I get me some? Is that, you know, do you think that, you know, legislation like that would be helpful?
Well, we're mostly focused on, you know, as I said, developing the technology, putting it out there. I mean, how various governments around the world deal, you know, the relationship between stakeholders and sellers is going to be different in every market. We're just trying to create the tools at Qualcomm and offer them up and say, look, here's a way for you to get at your spectrum crunch problem in a very elegant way without clearing new blocks of spectrum necessarily. Just use what you have.
Will we ever get out of the spectrum crunch?
Oh, I hope not. No. you know, it's interesting you say that. You know, I joke about Grumpy Cat, but the types of services I mentioned in response to your first question really only scratch the surface of what's coming. You know, the irony of talking about the mobile economy is that, you know, everybody's got a phone, everybody uses it for data, and we're all very, very comfortable with that notion. But we really have only scratched the surface on opening up these vertical markets. I talked about healthcare. You know, the notion that you'll have sensors on your body that can read, various vital statistics, get them to you on a real-time basis, monitor health conditions. That's going to require some type of spectrum, right? It's going to communicate. Education, only now taking off in some parts of the world. Interestingly, not the United States, but more outside the United States. The automotive sector. You know, some of our big customers now are car companies, which was not the case 3 or 4 years ago. Cars that not only, you know, provide information services for the driver and passengers, but can actually communicate with each other for collision avoidance, for traffic management, can communicate with pedestrians to reduce the likelihood of accidents involving them. So when all these vertical markets start to take off, and Qualcomm's doing a lot to try to seed the development of those markets, smart home's another one, then you're going to see, you know, an explosion of demand for new spectrum. It's going to be different types of spectrum. You know, at the end of the day, though, you know, the phone, your device, is going to be, you know, the remote control that essentially, you know, captures all this information and allows you, the user, to see it, to manipulate it, to use it as you see fit. All that's going to take a lot more spectrum. So it's almost like, you know, running to catch up. But the reason that we made the 1,000X challenge was we knew this day was coming, and we thought it was worth investing, you know, literally billions of dollars to solve it.
I saw an advertisement last night about a thermostat getting your house. It'll smart thermostat. I live in a 102-year-old house, and I'm going, how the heck is that going to work? we had other questions? Yes, sir.
Hi, Malcolm. Your experience with Qualcomm, you know, looking back from the inception, I'd like you to comment on how you've seen the regulatory environment, both here and abroad, evolving. And within the United States, you know, it's a very dynamic environment in so many spaces, in telecom, on spectrum, in antitrust, and the Internet. Internet governance, internet regulation, and also comment on how the deliberations in the United States are influencing regulatory actions abroad?
That's a big question. So I'll talk a little bit about regulation of the industry first, and then go into to IP, which I think is very interesting. On the regulation of the industry, when I first came to Qualcomm a long time ago, you know, we were just moving from second generation into third generation. Most people's phones were, you know, voice and text devices, those little Nokia candy bar phones that everybody used to have. And back then it was sort of a technology holy war. It was the folks who supported GSM on one side. There was Qualcomm supporting CDMA with our partners on the other. And the fights that governments had was over were over what technology to choose, right? You chose one band of spectrum for GSM, another band of spectrum for CDMA. We've gone beyond that, obviously. We now have, you know, chipsets that go into phones that work with any technology, virtually any band. You know, we've solved that through Moore's Law and other advances within the company. So now really the question is, how do you cover the uncovered? How do you get at this rural coverage problem? And how do you essentially make yourself the most attractive option for investment? You look at Africa, for example. You know, what's Nigeria doing versus Kenya to try to attract investment? Those are really interesting discussions, and the governments are taking very different approaches. The Kenyan government wants to set up a wholesale wireless operator and provide services essentially itself. Nigeria hasn't quite done that, so that's more of the competition. It's no longer the holy war. It's no longer a worry about what technology to choose. On the IP front, you know, sadly, there's been, I think, a real push to devalue intellectual property around the world. And it's a little bit what I mentioned, the companies that just, you know, have a different business model than inventor business models, and they want to limit their input costs. There are some developing countries that, you know, still have the attitude that they're buyers of intellectual property. They're not going to be sellers, despite what's happening. The fact that, you know, China is now leading in patent applications. And there's a lot of, you know, debate in the U.S. and Europe, almost at sort of a theoretical and academic level, about the so-called patent troll problem, about, you know, this notion of patent holdup. You know, a lot of academics get paid a lot of money to think and write these pieces, but there's no evidence. There's nothing on the ground that suggests there's a big problem in the wireless industry. To the contrary, people are falling all over themselves to invest in this industry. You know, the phone has advanced just so tremendously, even over the past 5 years, from what it was to what it is today. The core technology of the networks has gotten better. This is, you know, the very picture of a healthy industry. And why people want to change the intellectual property rules to correct a problem that doesn't exist should be a mystery to policymakers. And unfortunately, I think that discussion very much influences developing countries around the world. You know, we've had, you know, papers written by U.S. academics, comments from European regulatory officials repeated back to us in developing countries. So they have a lot of influence. And the question is that influence used for, you know, the type of model we have here and we've benefited from? Or does it, you know, essentially stimulate a round of change that would be very detrimental to American inventors?
One of the things you said earlier, it just seems fascinating to me because I was looking for my phone, but I guess it's in my coat, that, you know, for so many of us, this is a third appendage, right? You know, we're crossing the street, oh, my God, you know, or on the subway, you know, we constantly work on our phones.
We have a technology for that. Car's about to hit you, we'll communicate to you, so
it just because, you know, I'm an American and I haven't traveled around the world very much, it just, to me, is fascinating to think that there's most of the world isn't like us, that most of the world isn't glued to their phone, you know, but it obviously will stimulate those economies once that gets in. Once you know, in some ways, it's like, be more like us. Is this the thing?
Well, I don't think it's be more like us. I think usage patterns are actually interestingly very different around the world. you know, in the Philippines, one of the most important and most used application is an application that easily facilitates remittances of money from the United States back to the Philippines. Well, it's because there's a huge diaspora of community, particularly in San Diego, but throughout the country, and that's a big source of GDP for that country. Facebook is really popular some places; it's not popular in other places. So it differs from market to market. But I tell you, I've seen. I'll give you an example in India. When the tsunami hit Southeast Asia, a lot of people forget it. It also devastated Sri Lanka and the southeastern coast of India, a state called Tamil Nadu. And our wireless reach group got involved after that because what was happening is the fishermen were no longer willing to go out on their boats. And their boats are like dinghies at best. Some of them are just rafts. And they basically cast nets into the ocean to catch fish and bring them back. And then the women, their wives, clean the fish on the beach and sell them, basically haul them to market to sell. Well, they were worried, you know, justifiably for their safety. There was no tsunami warning system in place. So we financed the development of an application, which we call Fisherman Friend, which had the tsunami warning, had information from the central, their equivalent of NOAA in New Delhi, that sent them weather information, sent them information about the waves, how high they were, temperature, and also, crucially, what the price of fish was at the market that their wives had to haul the fish to. You know, stuff that's pretty basic. And this was an area of India that didn't really have third-generation coverage. So we also worked with the operator in question, say, can you just build out your network a little bit, cover this part of the beachfront. And, you know, sure enough, within a month, they were back in the ocean with more information. They were fishing more efficiently. Those are folks who never really used their phone before. If they did, it was for text or what have you. They're glued to their phone now, but it's a very different set of activities. So it's going to differ. If you build the infrastructure, build the application platforms, you know, every country will take off in a different way, but they'll all be glued to their phone for something.
Questions? Yes, sir.
So you mentioned that the most patent applications are done by Chinese companies. So can you tell us a little bit about how you see the presence of Chinese competitors in less developed countries like Africa, Latin America, or Asia?
Well, so the Chinese infrastructure and handset vendors, primarily Huawei, but also ZTE and some other companies, have been very aggressive and very successful in penetrating particularly sub-Saharan Africa and also Latin America to a little bit lower extent. You know, a lot of that is, you know, it kind of comes in the form of aid from the Chinese government when they, you know, do major trade or economic deals with the countries in question. And they've done a lot. They've poured a lot of investment into these regions and done a lot to improve the state of mobile telecommunications. We partner with them in many of these regions. Although our activities in Africa are mostly focused on operators, trying to counsel the operators on how best to serve, you know, some very challenging populations in terms of topography, in terms of the distance between communities. So we try to provide engineering services as part of our partnerships with them to solve those problems. And then we do a lot of work directly with governments in Africa, trying to inform, you know, we basically made the point to them that if Africa would just work together, you know, as opposed to regionally, East Africa versus West Africa versus the southern states, if they would just combine forces and get one plan for spectrum, one plan for regulatory management, I mean, that's a billion-person addressable market. And they could start to have a lot more influence internationally. And I'm very glad to say that is what's happened. There's now a degree of cooperation in Africa that wasn't really present 5 years ago.
Is there a danger to the United States for all these Chinese patent applications?
No, we think competition. I mean, look, we're a company that has benefited from, you know, market system, competition between various players. It just, you know, from the perspective of a technology innovator, it makes us get up a little bit earlier, work a little bit harder to stay ahead. You know, Qualcomm's always been looking at least 5 years in the future, usually 10 or 15 years in the future. We're not a we do make chips for phones, but we're not really a product company in that sense. We're not making phones for sale. We're not making network equipment, which makes us very different from a Huawei or a Nokia or an Ericsson. So we're looking at core technologies, enabling technologies. We're looking at how the network is going to evolve over time. So we have a slightly, I think, different focus than a lot of these other companies. But we welcome competition in whatever form it takes.
All right, I think that's got us. Thank you so much, and thank everyone for coming out on the call today.
Thank you.
I'm going to shake your hand, but I have that cold thing. Oops, I'm tangled up.
I'm tangled up, too.
Okay, so thank you, Brooks, and thank you, Bill, for sharing your thoughts with us. Our second panel is going to explore the global mobile ecosystem, and we have two experts who are going to share some of their thoughts on these topics. So Sanjay Puri is the founder and president of the Alliance for U.S.-India Business Alliance, and he has worked in a number of different aspects of mobile technology. He helped to form a congressional task force on U.S.-India investment and trade relations, which comprised several members of Congress. He speaks frequently on U.S.-India relations and the political impact of the Indian-American community. He also is the chairman of the U.S.-India Political Action Committee, which is an independent, bipartisan political action committee. Kishore Nagira is senior manager at Caribou Digital. He has spent nearly 10 years of professional experience advising private companies, NGOs, and government clients in the telecom sector. Previously, he worked in the United States Agency for International Development, and he joined the digital development team where he worked on helping to expand digital access across the agency's target countries. So I want to start with Sanjay. So I know you're very knowledgeable about India and the mobile and telecommunications sector there. What are the opportunities that you're seeing in the mobile space?
You know, we were discussing before I came in the green room. It's a great time to be an entrepreneur in India. When, you know, you have a company called Flipkart, which is the Amazon equivalent, which has a market cap of $10 billion. And I'm sure some of the old Indian business companies that have been around for 100 years and they've got a market cap of $8 billion are wondering what the hell did we do wrong. So I think the mobile technology devices and the growth of internet penetration and e-commerce has really done a lot. And I think the focus has really been on the online shopping and things of that nature. But when you look at India, you know, 70% of the economy still resides in the rural area. It has changed a lot of things out there because today the farmer can know what is the price of my crop by going on a smartphone. Because in India, you know, this device is their computer. I mean, that's all they have. People are not, I don't see too many people sitting on a desktop using computers. So you can know what your price is. You can plan based on weather information that is coming to you. So I would say the opportunities, obviously, people are talking about e-commerce, which has, you know, again, opportunities in the rural areas. Rural areas are not ones where the fancy malls are coming up. So if, and there are very successful, wealthy people in the rural areas or tier two cities, as they call them in India, or tier three cities, they can acquire an iPhone or stuff like that from e-commerce sites. So I would say the opportunities are amazing because you have a demographic of a population, 70% people below the age of 35, mobile adoption is just exploding. And now finances, private equity money is coming in. Now, obviously, the downside of it is you got too much, they say, good money chasing bad deals now because the froth is so much, and we've seen this movie play out here in the United States. So you're going to see some bad investments, and people will start going to pull back. But I would say target the tier two, tier three, target mobile payments. I think agribusinesses, I think the opportunities are just across the board, and taking some of the models we built in the United States, localize it. Because if in India, you people still have very less adoption of credit cards, so it's basically cash on delivery. So those kinds of opportunities have really popped up.
Okay. Kishore, you advise a number of different players in the digital world. What are the opportunities that you're seeing?
Much to what Sanjay had said, the opportunities are fantastic, phenomenal, and profound. We can look at it from a very much a sector perspective, that from agriculture you have an opportunity to connect a farmer to agriculture information, weather information. From health, you have the opportunity to connect all kinds of different services to those who've been financial services. It's the first time to connect and provide checking, savings opportunities. And for the first time, you can actually build credit scores for some demographic that's been marginalized. So that's kind of an approach to look at it when it's a sector-based. But when we take a step back, what's particularly fascinating is that we look at it in totality. What we're building, essentially, is a digital economy. And so for the first time, you're now starting to have a new viable economy based off of what the services provided off of a mobile phone. Quite profound and exciting, to say the least.
So each of you have talked about some of the opportunities. What are the barriers to innovation that each of you are seeing?
You know, in India, obviously, infrastructure is still a big challenge. I mean, Kishore and I were talking about that still, you know, we at best in India right now is 3G. They're looking at a 4G adoption that is happening. E-commerce delivery is a big challenge out there. And also e-commerce penetration, internet penetration is still about 15%. So I think those are the challenges, but you can look at the upside too. If the internet penetration grows as the speed of 4G LTE is going to come up, I think it's really going to explode out there. And I think the mindset where people are hesitant to use credit cards, because firstly, you know, 10% of the population has credit cards, so they're hesitant, and when you do cash on delivery, it really adds a big cost to the supplier, and people can refuse delivery. So I think those are some of the challenges that are happening.
I would say that, again, very similar to that. So what Sanjay had said, that some of the barriers very much can lie with infrastructure. So the towers and the extent to which they can provide connectivity is always a concern. The price of handsets. So now if we're building a digital economy, a very much an app-based economy, it's going to run off of high data usage. 3G is in markets that I'm particularly familiar with, Africa, 3G is only about 15% penetration. So it's not necessarily reaching that particular market. Now, moving beyond just the infrastructure, there's also concerns about the principal drivers of a digital economy. Our perspective, it's small businesses and entrepreneurs. As an entrepreneur, there's a handful of issues that they have when trying to provide a service and create a business into this particular roughly, there's a couple that come to mind. One is actually having the technical skills and the business acumen to be able to provide the services. Number two is access to capital. For starting up a business, seed capital is extremely hard to come by, and from reports that some of my colleagues have written, the biggest challenge for them is being able to acquire the capital to start a business. And in fact, entrepreneurs generally attract the capital from family and friends. And then the third is, as it is right now, the mobile network operator is the primary facilitator of the digital economy. And so with them being sort of the hegemon for creating this economy, there is a great deal of bureaucracy that they have to deal with, a great deal of lack of transparency, and then just being able to negotiate with the mobile extremely huge challenge from what we
do. So the new prime minister in India recently attracted a lot of attention for various types of reforms that he has proposed, but one in particular emphasizes financial inclusion and the need to include people who currently lack access to traditional financial services. So I'm curious how you see him being able to navigate the bureaucracy, the regulatory restrictions that now make it difficult to for people other than the banks to handle financial transactions. How do you see that initiative going, each of you?
Well, you know, he started what is called in India the Jan Dhan Yojana, which means having a bank account for every family, and they've signed up, which is what amazes me, and that can happen in India or countries like China, that they've signed up in, I think, 4 months, 70 million new bank accounts. So, you know, the idea is that the savings rate in India is one of the highest in the world, that instead of putting money in your mattresses, et cetera, put them in the bank, you earn interest, you use that for transactions, the liquidity helps the country finance infrastructure, et cetera. But I think that's what he and this prime minister, and this, it's very important to note, he's the most probably the digitally savvy leader that India's had. And, you know, he's got one of the largest Twitter followings. He communicates with the country through Twitter, social media, et cetera. And his push really is digital. As Kishore talked about, the digital economy, everything he says has got to go online. And for that to happen, penetration has to happen. So in terms of financial inclusion, as you talked about, these bank accounts are all going to be operated through smartphones. And smartphone adoption is growing dramatically because it's gotten cheaper, whether it's through imported handsets, local handsets. There are a lot of opportunities that are happening there.
So I by no means pledge myself as an expert on financial inclusion, but what I can see the Prime Minister being able to charge, given his position, and making a substantive influence can come across on three different fronts. I think one is being able to push the regulatory environment so that the banks and telecom operators can work with one another and cooperate. In previous markets, it's generally a telecom-led model, which can sometimes bank accounts and with the banking model. So if they can work in collaboration, it can definitely push things ahead. What's also particularly excited with having Modi generate and push the charge is that he can actually drive and make the infrastructure changes to allow and facilitate the mobile network operators to be able to provide and have the bandwidth to support the transactions that happen through savings or that they can, so that consumers can save. But more importantly, and what's particularly exciting about financial inclusion, it's not only just a savings component, but is when financial inclusion is tacked onto another particular service. So in markets that we've seen, that what's really exciting is when financial inclusion or financial payments, digital payments, is latched onto a particular service. So items like pay-as-you-go solar lanterns or pay-as-you-go lighting can now be enabled. So as a principal driver of demand, could then necessarily facilitate a driver for the Prime Minister to sort of take his stance as the head of the state to be able to push the regulatory environment. So
each of you have mentioned several different kinds of barriers to innovation. So we've talked a little bit about infrastructure issues. We talked about the policy and regulatory environment. We know the cost of devices and cost of telecommunications connections can be a barrier. What do you think would be the best steps to overcome some of these barriers?
You know, in terms of best steps to overcome some of these barriers, you know, as he said, Kishore said, you know, there has to really be a push from the top. And India, with Modi coming in, that has started really emphasizing that decisions need to get made. You know, they have a problem with having FDI in retail. Well, smart entrepreneurs found out that maybe they don't have a barrier on online retail. So you got every VC and private equity firm now pushing money into online retail. But they don't sell products. They've created a marketplace. So, you know, entrepreneurs, it's like Alibaba. Amazon runs a marketplace out there in India. So you have these small entrepreneurs who put on their storefronts on there. So I think leadership from the policymakers is important. Entrepreneurship in India and probably in some of these other countries, you know, failure is not an option. It's a very embarrassing thing for an entrepreneur to fail. But I think with money now coming in, failures are going to happen because so much money is flowing into their incubators are starting up there. So entrepreneurship needs to thrive. Failures need to be accepted. And I think those things, and then push on infrastructure. Infrastructure is really where the Prime Minister is putting a lot of effort on, where, you know, the telecom infrastructure, the roads, ports, etc., because e-commerce to Thai, really, that needs to happen. It can't just be people on motorcycles dropping stuff off, because that can only go on for so long.
So I would say that one of the biggest considerations and impediments to innovation lies with what the mobile network operators. They tend to be the person and entity that allows and facilitates the of entrepreneurs to be able to create applications for consumers to be. But I think what's particularly exciting, and maybe to pivot off of the limitation thing about an opportunity, is that for the first time we're now able to see a viable alternative to the mobile network operator. And now we're starting to see the growth of Wi-Fi as an enabler, as an opportunity to connect to consumers independent of the network operator. So with that being, with access to Wi-Fi now starting to grow at a rate comparable to that of 3G, we're now starting to be able to see opportunities for entrepreneurs to be able to provide a service without dealing with much of the headaches that come with working directly with.
How is India handling intellectual property issues, particularly as it relates to the mobile sector?
You know, intellectual property has been a controversial issue and not specifically related to mobile because they've had a battle going on, or I would say, let's not say battle, they have a disagreement of opinion with the United States on the pharmaceutical intellectual property issue. But on mobile, you know, they've had an issue with the payment gateway. PayPal doesn't exist in India. I mean, they're not allowed to function in India. And with Uber, which is right now in a big controversy in India, you know, their payment gateway is very, very different, where they put these, you got to put money into those cards in India, and only then can you use that. So I think the new government is really beginning to understand that they really need to get with the program in terms of intellectual property if they want to continue to attract in FDI investments, et cetera, which this prime minister really wants to do.
Intellectual property is a huge concern when it relates to privacy issues for the consumer as it relates to, again, building up this digital economy. When we're in emerging markets, one of the big issues that, you know, market analysts cite is the rule of law. And so with the rule of law being as fungible in different in various markets, it's very challenging for consumers who want to be able to log on to the digital economy for time to ensure that their information is confidential and private. And so I don't have a great answer in terms of what is the solution, but that is a huge concern, particularly as this economy is growing. What we see in the States, and that's what Sanjay mentioned, is that even in the States, even in the Western markets, intellectual property with as it relates to app-based companies is extremely challenging. Uber is able to sort of dominate the market and be able to withhold all of their privacy information. But as an appropriate counterpart to that is that you have a strong government that can act on behalf of the consumer. In emerging markets, that strong government is lost. And so in order for, I think, the digital economy to thrive is that you need a stronger government as it relates to protecting the rights of the consumer.
Wasn't Uber just banned in Delhi?
I was talking about that was a strong government. So they've been banned in Delhi and could be in other cities too. It's a thing that's playing out right now in a big way.
So I know China has been very successful at following a manufacturing strategy, and you know obviously they make a lot of telecom and technology and mobile products. How do you see, and then China has also been very successful at attracting a foreign direct investment. Do you see India following the Chinese strategy? Is India trying to develop its own approach to economic development? How do you see the comparison and the contrast of India and China?
You know, the Prime Minister has a Make in India strategy where he's really emphasizing manufacturing. I mean, when he was here about 3 months ago, and the key thing that he was asking was manufacturers to come to India in the sense he said that India wants to be a manufacturing hub. But for that to happen, there are several things that need to happen. They need to reform the Land Act because it's still pretty complicated because in order to set up manufacturing, you want to have that. And they have to reform the labor laws, which again is in the process. So India can compete on high-end manufacturing, and they're going to do their own thing vis-a-vis. It won't be replicating what China has because of the challenges they have with the labor laws. They have a pretty strong union base and also the land issue that exists. But on high-end manufacturing, that's where India wants to play, whether it's in chipsets, in telecom units, et cetera. And I think they're starting to see success because the Japanese have come in and, you know, the Prime Minister went to Japan. They are coming in now in a big way because obviously there's, you know, they're considering the risk profile of their investments in China and want to move some of that to India.
I think the best way I can answer that question is when it comes to investments into emerging markets as it relates to, again, building the digital economy. India versus China, I think China has very much an all-hands-on-deck, ready-to-go approach as it comes to investments in emerging markets. Their position is less on what the state of rule of law is and what the business opportunity is. India, much like most of the Western market, is a little bit tentative of moving into that. So we're starting to see, as a previous speaker had mentioned, that you're starting to see a flood of Chinese-based products moving into parts of Africa, much because they're not afraid of trying to generate business.
Okay. Why don't we open the floor to questions from you? So if you have a question, just raise your hand and we will get a microphone over to you. In the very back, there's a question.
Thank you. Jacqueline Irving. I'm with U.S. Treasury Senior Economist, focusing on financial inclusion issues. So I understand, you know, that there's been a huge increase in accounts opened in India. You mentioned 70 million in a very short period of time. But what do you think regulators need to do, and what can the private sector do to prevent those accounts lying dormant, to actually get them to advance financial inclusion? Because, of course, that's happened in the past where there was a large increase in accounts opened, but they didn't actually lead to a very big increase in savings.
I talked about the account opening. I didn't talk about how many are actually being in use. But I think you hit the nail on the head, and I think that's what they're doing is they're now he's really got his chief ministers, the governor equivalent of governors in states, and that's what they did, was to really push out, and he's also pushing his party to talk about actually people using their accounts, because I think from what some of the numbers are, that three-fourths of those accounts have zero balances in there, which is obviously not where they want to go. But the push now is to really get people to actually use those accounts and not just have them as a symbol, and the party is making a push, the chief ministers are making a push. It really is going to come in where there's an awareness, there's an education. What they've done is he's given 100,000 rupees as an insurance cover. If you open an account, you automatically get 100,000, and now they're also pushing some debit cards, etc. So the goal is to give some enticements so that people continue to really use them and continue to engage with them. But remember, putting money under mattresses or holding on to it within different ways has been going on for decades, and it's going to take a little while. But I think they've got a little bit of a good start. If they continue giving some incentives to people, I think there could be an opportunity for them.
The question was how to change the mindset.
Well, the mindset, again, is going to change with the next generation of people, because you got to understand the older demographic is the one that's been putting money under the mattress. So the younger generation, their kids are looking at spending that money. So as we all, if any of us have kids, probably can relate to that too in any country in the world. So I think that's where the mind shift is happening. And watching TV, seeing opportunities to buy stuff. All these e-commerce sites are advertising, you can buy this cheap, you can buy that cheap. Well, you kind of have to have a credit card, you kind of have to have a bank account. You can't keep forking out cash ultimately. So I think that's what's going to happen. The change in demographics, the new generation, that's what's going to happen.
If I may just piggyback on that, I think what would be necessary in order for financial inclusion to take off is that the providers, if it's being a telecom-led market, need to engage in aggressive marketing campaigns that are very much contextualized to the demographic that they're trying to. And then they need to really engage in education components so that for the first time, consumers who are using a smartphone for the first time have absolutely no idea how to use it. So first off, I think thinking about the user experience and how a consumer might actually use their smartphone in order to engage it, probably step one in order to figure out, A, what is it that we're trying to achieve? How then will we be able to achieve it? And then what are our goals? And then, so I think that will probably at least generate the interest behind it. And then sort of if that is able to succeed, I think it's then allowing the telecom market to move as a primary driver of financial inclusion in that being telecom-led allows it to grow at a much faster rate than if it was to be bank-led. So I think if you gauge in static reforms being based on marketing, education, and user experience to understand the consumer, to drive the marketing campaign, you'll generate interest in the static term. Think about in the long term, I think having a mobile network operators being the primary facilitator for it might actually be advantageous.
Other questions? Here. The microphone coming up right behind you.
My name is Li Yang. I appreciate that the presentations, because mobile tech is very important, very essential for consumers, for business, for company, and for government. But there is a technology, there's an innovation, there are always there's abuse and misuse, and there is security problem, the government surveillance or record or destroy and hacking and everything. So is there any information that you can address, some kind of studies, they will tell you how much loss economically about this damage by abuse and misuse, and how what percentage are done by the government agencies and by the hacking industries.
I don't have a direct answer to that. I don't have numbers to be able to substantiate what I'll say. But what I will argue at this point is that in these particular markets, so thinking less West, more in the emerging market, telecom and the app world, is that this is very nascent. And so when it comes to hacking, my hypothesis is that it isn't as fervent as perhaps as it is in the West and as it is. But in order to prevent and curb some of that, I think what's important is that the telecoms retain some of their licensing. The telecom market is extremely aggressive in order to retain confidentiality. So if they're able to sustain that, that's one sort of way to thwart potential hacking. And then two is the role and the strength of the government, and that the government needs to be able to be defending and in pursuit of the consumer's rights in order to be able to provide a viable way to secure what a consumer might go through as potential hackies.
So each of you mentioned the mobile payment area and also e-commerce as sectors that have really taken off. So I'm just curious, what allowed those sectors to take off, and what have been the barriers to the other sectors that have not yet taken off to the same extent?
You know, the e-commerce sector obviously has taken off because, young demographic figured out that these guys are selling products below their cost price, and just being very frank with you, these guys are selling goods below their cost price. So I was just talking to some of the retail folks. Footfalls in malls have dropped by 20%, which is shocking because that's a big number. So some of these sales are being subsidized because what people are hoping is that they lure these customers in there. And at least I can tell you, in India, they are value shoppers. They'll shop, they'll check, they'll compare shop, and maybe they'll finally then end up at the mall, but they will do a lot of shop checking around. So they're saving a lot of time, they're saving a lot of money. So I think that's part of what has really helped. And then the largest number of products that are being bought are basically technology products, and it's being bought by people who are technologically savvy. So that's kind of what has helped with the young generation of people wanting to buy these new smartphones, these televisions, etc. And as far as mobile payments is concerned, that was something that had to happen. I have to tell you, I'm very impressed with some of the things that are happening. And, I have a bank account in India, and I can do practically way more things on my smartphone there than I can do here, because they kind of jumped from the landlines to the mobile technology. So a lot of the things that they're offering have gone straight, these private banks, to us. So I think that those are some of the reasons why they've happened. I don't know what you think about them.
So with mobile payments, in the past 5 to 10 years, we've gone from 50 or so different deployments to almost 200 deployments. And I think one of the reasons why that took off was the success of M-Pesa. M-Pesa being a mobile-based payment in Kenya provided by Safaricom. a lot of theories as to why that took off. One that I particularly subscribed to was that in addition to having the proper infrastructure, in addition to having the monopoly being the primary driver of this new idea, was that there was violence going on in 2007 for the Kenyan elections. And so when people were getting robbed from their homes with the cash they stored underneath their mattresses, when the alternative was to continue and see what would happen if they left their money in their mattresses given all the violence, or they could try out this new creative, innovative solution of trying to put money into a savings account, well, of course, they're going to try something new. They're going to try to protect their money. And I think once they realized that they could actually physically protect their money, I think that sort of ensured that this actually has some viability, that this is actually a sensible product. So that's why I think mobile payments has been able to succeed in certain markets. In other markets, they have not been able to succeed because I don't think they did. The mobile network operator was perhaps not able to understand the consumer needs and to be able to market their particular product so it meets what the consumers want as well as what the consumers understand. As it relates to other sectors, so health and agriculture, I think there's several different reasons why those may not have succeeded or as taken off as quickly as mobile-based payments. I would argue that it's a much more time-intensive process when you're starting to push agriculture information and health. Health information is an extremely challenging one to make profitable, and it's a market that it's hard to define why the consumer should pay for it. With agriculture, it's more trying to it's incentivizing the individual consumer to see the value of what they're trying to buy. And with what they're trying to buy, so let's say we're providing agriculture-based content on a smartphone, well, now we've just now introduced a couple different variables and makes it extremely challenging for that particular product to take off. One, you need a smartphone. Two, you need to ensure that the consumer knows how to use a smartphone. Three, we have issues of connectivity. And four, we have issues of data. So these four components make it extremely challenging for all these alternative interventions to take off because it's costly and they take a lot of data.
Other questions? Right here on the aisle.
I am Fred Altman. And worldwide, and I presume in India too, there's a move of the population to cities. And I was wondering, how does the mobile technology contribute or hinder this movement?
In India, there's a big movement towards cities. You just have to go to some of the cities to see that there is a big movement. The perception is that only city people use mobile technology, and I have to tell you, because I just came back from India and I traveled to for some work to the smaller, more remote parts of India, and things are changing dramatically out there. In India, there is, I would say there are about 100 million people who work in ancillary jobs, whether they could be security guards, they could be help at home, etc. They are all onto mobile technology now. I mean, it is shocking to me that whether it is travel, whether it is connecting back to their villages or things of that nature. So I think urbanization is a fact of India. This prime minister has talked about creating 100 new smart cities because the current cities just cannot handle the shift. 40% people are expected to move to these cities. But I think if they create the smart cities, there is a digital economy, as he talked about, maybe the stress would not be as much on these big cities. I don't know. Do you have any perspective on that?
Only thought that I can offer is that if I understand the question is that it with the growth of mobile tech and how it's being able to connect, you're starting to see a growth moving towards the big, perhaps as a function of that. And I would say that, I would answer it in two different parts. I would say one is that perhaps that migration into the cities as it relates to a digital economy is that you're starting to see the potential of entrepreneurs being able to meet their market, understand the market as it relates to the big city. And in addition to that is access to capital. It's easier to find capital in a bigger city. But when we talk about penetration rates, I would actually argue that it's quite strong in the rural areas. Bit of an anecdote, I was doing a case interview back when I was consulting in Uganda, and we were interviewing rural farmers, and it was almost impossible to get the farmers to stand still and answer the questions because they kept getting phone calls. And so that just goes to show just how strong the strength of signal is in some of these markets, so that you are starting to see that though there is a migration, it's for different reasons, not necessarily relating to degree of connectivity.
So you mentioned this proposal for new smart cities. What does he have in mind? What's he trying to do? And how would that
Well, it really gets to what his point was, that there's a lot of pressure right now. If you go to a city like Mumbai, or you go to a city like Delhi or Bangalore, et cetera, they have kind of reached the edge of what they can handle. And, you know, the migration, it continues and continues. So what he has in mind is to create clusters, and they've listed out about 100 cities. You take these tier two cities and really provide them state of the art. What his, you know, ideal city would be in Singapore. And they basically signed an agreement with Singapore, which is providing them expertise in terms of creating some of these smart cities. And also China, they signed an MOU with them in terms of creating planned cities with state-of-the-art infrastructure, especially from a telecommunication, from a technology, et cetera, so that people don't have to continuously move to these 8-10 big cities, which really don't have the capacity, whether it's a Chennai, it's a Bombay, they just don't have that capacity anymore.
Other questions? So in our last session, Bill Bold mentioned that there are some places that are imposing local content requirements, either on mobile operators or on the digital ecosystem in general. And I think he mentioned Indonesia as a place that had mentioned this. Are you seeing this as something that is becoming more prevalent in other places? Is this taking place in India? Are there other countries in that part of the world?
So with local content, it is a facilitator to drive consumers to start using their smartphone for alternative services. It is a way for consumers to now see the value of their phone, be it smart or not, be it smart or featured, to extend beyond just the standard mobile, the standard talking on the phone and SMS. Digital content is a huge driver that can be very much from a top-down perspective, so based on what the government is pushing, so e-government services now being available online, which mobile being the primary use for how people get online, as well as from bottom up, which is now an opportunity for consumers who want to be able to publish their own content, can now have an opportunity to write and to be able to publish, to be able to provide an understanding of what the local community is about. So local content, digital content, is a primary facilitator and driver for people to get online and to actually see the use of both the content, but more importantly, what the internet can provide.
In India, just a little bit of a different segue from local content. When you go from one part of India to another part of India, it's almost like going from one country to another country, because the language, the culture, the systems, etc., are so very different. So when you talked about the challenges or the opportunities for some of these companies, they really have to keep that in mind, because what plays in the north of India does not, from a language, culture, even buying habits is so dramatically different. Where you go to Gujarat, very different than what you go to Punjab, or you go to Bombay versus you go to Chennai. So I think you really have to be sensitive in India about that, even though the mobile is a unifying force, but localization within that area is also an important part.
So you mentioned government services. How much progress have governments in India made in configuring their services for mobile devices in particular?
Well, you know, it depends on which parts. You know, the reason this prime minister won in a big way was what he did when he was the chief minister or the governor of his state of Gujarat. Gujarat has put its land records online. It's put a lot of its services online. And now some of these governments are much more progressive when you look at Madhya Pradesh and Chhattisgarh, etc. But each state is trying to do its own thing. The central government now, with the federal government now, with him coming in, has a real directive that put everything, even environmental clearances, are going online, because environmental clearances can hold up your business for a couple of years. Now he says you've got to make a decision in 30 days and you get your clearances up front, because the big thing that they're trying to do is make India a much easier place to do business. I mean, his goal is that currently it's 140 in terms of ease of doing business. He wants to bring it down to 50 in the next few years. So digital is his way of doing it.
Okay. We're going to make that the benediction on this event, but we thank you very much for coming out. And I want to thank Sanjay and Kishore for sharing your thoughts as well. Thank you very much.